from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with Vermont author Emily Arneson Casey, whose debut book is Made Holy, a collection of essays. Made Holy tells the story of the American family. Love, loss, and addiction entwine in this moving debut collection. Emily Arneson Casey employs the lyric imagination to probe memory and the ever-shifting lens of time as she seeks to make sense of the disease that haunts her maternal family tree and the alchemy of loss and longing. The lakes of her childhood in Minnesota form the interior landscape of this book, a kind of watery nostalgia for something just beyond her reach. I know this feeling, she writes, we travel along the surface of time, and then suddenly the layers give way and we are in another year, another body, another place. Emily's willingness to honestly examine the past and present with contemplative lyricism offers fresh perspective and new understanding. In electric moments that are utterly relatable, she weaves a tale of love and commitment to the truth of her experience, despite the incredible desire to keep alive a legacy of secrets. Like the mullein plant she invokes in the final essay, these essays form a kind of guardian to the lost, and that's a quote from the book. Emily Arneson Casey is a writer, teacher, and activist, originally from northern Minnesota. She currently lives in rural Vermont with her family. She graduated from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, with a bachelor in English literature and minor in cultural studies and comparative literature, and earned her MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts, where she studied fiction and creative nonfiction. Her writing has appeared in The Rumpus, The Briar Cliff Review, Hotel America, The Normal School, Hunger Mountain, American Literary Review, and her essay Laughing Water received a Notables listing in the Best American Essay series. Made Holy is published as part of the University of Georgia Press Crux series in literary nonfiction. Her work has been supported in part by a grant from the Vermont Arts Council. Emily is an instructor at the Community College of Vermont, Winooski, since 2012, where she teaches English and multidisciplinary studies and serves as a steward in her faculty union. She works with writers as a manuscript consultant, editor, and writing coach, and she is sitting with me here now. It's really weird to, like, talk about her while she's sitting right across from me. Emily, welcome to Write the Book. It's great to have you, and thank you for being here. So Emily and I talked ahead of time, and we decided that it might be nice for her to start by our conversation by reading from Made Holy.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to read the beginning of the essay, That Kind of Blue. She stands on the deck of the burnt shanty cabin, a half silhouette in the waning light of August. We are in our 20s. Grandma's still alive. Our sister's with us. Her mother healthy. The cabin is still the place to which we all return, a longed-for destination full of childhood memories and girlhood. I see her there, surrounded by all of us, sisters, mothers, grandma, our world of matriarchy. Only once have I returned to the lake cabin our grandfather built in the 1950s, since she hid there with the skinny man she still loves, stealing wood from the neighbors for a November fire that would have done little for those uninsulated rooms. Getting messed up the way we once did together, but too far gone now, alone in different eras. Our other members of our family have done the same, the disease running thick in our blood, and the cabin deep in the woods. Soon the cabin will be gone, sold to a rich doctor from out east. They will most likely bulldoze it and erect a quaint but modern replacement. The sidewalk where we pressed our hands in wet cement and wrote our names, me, the oldest, first, she, second, in our line of cousins, following close behind, broken up, hauled away. Would the new children find our path to the birch trees, to the point of land jutting out at the end of the bay, so easily seen by our mothers from the deck of the cabin or the dock, the place we called the point, that had been our own mother's fort as girls? Would they run barefoot, leaping over the tree roots that snaked from the earth all the way there? and would they take care to avoid the swampy water near the pass edge where she and I once swam, and stepping out of the lake discovered our legs were covered in thick black leeches. We lay in the grass fake screaming while our mothers shook salt on the offending creatures. From my desk, I look out the window at the winter trees reflected in the broken ice of puddles. They look fogged and half imaginary. In looking, I find longing a body of pain. I long for the trigger that shuts down the thinking mind, lets us live there in the currents of the underworld, lower brain, place of ancestry and myth, a place we drank to get to. But in sobriety, I have discovered certain clouds on windy days and blue-fielded skies transport me there. Certain memories, if only for a moment, pockets of blue, I call them. You, I want to tell her, you would know the sky if I told you that its color, blue like the veins of our skin, tastes of water and sun, and those clouds smell like the lake when we were children and dove down into it, searching for pretty stones, holding our breath as long as we could, playing underwater tea party. We swam until our eyes stung and heads burned from the sun, and we were so tired that all we wanted was to sit in our mother's laps, their warm legs slick with tanning oil, curled against their breasts for one eternal moment. You would understand that kind of blue. There in the blue of sky, a limbo of sensory memory and otherworldliness, time folds in on itself, shuts down, and we float free, soul and body free. I meet you there in the other world, the world before, one of childhood water and sun, footpath to fort, sauna, and mother love. My son needs me. I'm going to quit, she says into the phone, half a century country between us. It's been months since anyone has heard from her. I thought I would never see you again, I tell her, sitting on the floor of my kitchen, my body taut and anxious. I can see hear my husband speaking softly in the next room. I know, me too. Sorry, man. I am desperate to say the right thing, but the distance between us evades connection, the fear of losing her too much. Her own survival takes precedence over tending to the pain of those who love her.
Thank you so much for reading that.
Yeah.
Such a lovely collection, and the prose is just so beautiful. But actually, I think I'll start by just mentioning, so this essay that you were just reading was actually directed a little bit towards your cousin,
mm-hmm.
Your mother's sister's daughter, and as a presence, she is sort of both there and not there throughout the collection, because you were very close when you were younger,
yeah,
and you've tried to find a connection as an adult. So anyway, I just thought,
yeah,
I'd mention that. Earlier in the book, you have a line, I am the keeper of the family secrets and the guardian to the lost. I loved that line. And actually, I didn't realize when I wrote the question that that was the guardian of to the lost that the publisher puts on your jacket. What does this mean to you? I am the keeper of family secrets and the guardian to the lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's secrets, I think, play a big role in the book as a theme. And they're both my own secrets as a child growing up, and family secrets around alcoholism and addiction. And I think in terms of addiction, our secrets are what keep us sick often. So that's a major theme in trying to understand addiction and alcoholism. And I wrote the book in part to break out of that taboo of what those things are. But I also feel like as a writer and maybe as a person in the world, I'm trying to keep track of all the pieces, and I don't want to let go, and I don't want to lose those memories, and I'm constantly going back into that landscape of memory and recreating it for myself, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No, I ran across a review that just a reader had written. I don't remember where I saw it, maybe on Goodreads or something, and very complimentary about how well you remember your life and the vivid detail you put into your memories on the page. And I thought that was really a very astute comment. I thought it was really true. So have you been a journaler all your life? How do you think you've managed to keep your memories so vivid?
No, I haven't been a journaler. I mean, my first diary I got when I was in the second grade, and I wrote in that same book until the ninth grade.
So unless it was really, really big.
But the world comes alive in writing for me through describing and remembering details and moments. And so there's certain moments in my memory that stand out, and then I spend a lot of time piecing them together and recreating them. Mm-hmm. It really comes out of the process of writing, I think. Mm-hmm. And description is just so poignant for me. That's where I mean, it is in memoir in general, I think.
Mm-hmm. So. I found myself wondering if you, first of all, are also a poet and if you read a lot of poetry.
Well, I started out as a poet. I mean, I think every writer does, really. But I do read poetry on and off, like certain times of year, and it depends on what I'm writing. I will, but yes, historically, I've read a lot of poetry, and the lyric essay it's that combination of poetry and prose to me that makes so much sense and really fits the way I see the world and think about the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I want to get back to what we started about a minute ago, which mm-hmm. was about being a keeper of secrets. So as you worked and secrets were actually coming out on the page, was that liberating or was that terrifying or how did that feel?
Yeah. Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about what I could and couldn't write, and was I being true to my story and fair to other people, right? This is the question all memoirists and essayists, I think, struggle with.
Right.
And I remember I kept talking to my sisters about it. I have four sisters and a brother, but I was talking to my sisters about it, and they kept saying, there must be something written about this. Can't you research it or something? I was like, I don't know. I haven't come up with anything interesting. And writers have their own rules around it. I did research that. So it was a struggle to figure it out, but when you're telling the story of your life, there's other people in it. And for me in particular, I wanted to tell the story of alcoholism without secrets, because the secrets are really what I think are so devastating to a family that is struggling with that disease. Mm-hmm. But I danced around that. And I don't know that there was never a moment in writing where I was like, made a discovery about something. It was often just remembering and then putting the memories together and deciding which story or narrative went where and how it connected and how I was presenting the information. It's just all about that presentation. It's so interesting because it's not, nothing's really... everyone has their own interpretation of what happened.
The other thing that I find really interesting is that both of the last two questions that I've asked you have turned out to have some aspect of process as the answer. Isn't that interesting? Okay, so I wonder if you can speak to this quote from earlier in your book as a writer of narrative nonfiction. You write, "The mind of time writes meaning on the play of memory." I love that. That was great.
Thank you. So I think that's from The Cabin, the first essay.
Yeah.
And I did think a lot of about the way in any moment in our life, we are thinking about the past in a different way because we've gone through more time and we've had more experience. Mm. So there's this play that happens with interpretation. So perhaps when I started writing these essays, I had one idea about what something was. And, you know, years went by and that changes, honestly. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's great. Now, the book has, I think, it's got several themes, if we're going to talk about themes, but I felt that solitude and isolation and the joy of being solitary, but also the depression involved in being isolated involuntarily, these all were very interesting throughout the book. They were interwoven. You have the line, "There was nothing delicious about involuntary solitude." Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of thinking about being alone. And I don't know if I have a question about that. I just thought that it was interesting. Was that obvious to you as you started to write that that was going to be a strong aspect of what you were writing about, or did that happen again as you worked?
Yeah, I mean, the book was a very process-oriented book, but yeah. Growing up in a large family as the oldest of six kids, so trying to get to be alone. That was crazy. But then when you are alone, sometimes, you know, for me, until the last decade or so, I didn't know what to do with myself alone. So, and now as a different person living in recovery, I love, and having my own children, I love solitude. I love being alone in my house more than almost anything. So.
Yeah. Now, I remember when my kids were young, and I don't know exactly how old your kids are right now. Are they like elementary school and younger?
Yeah, 5 and 7.
Yeah. So do you play music when you're alone, or do you just have silence? Like absolutely nothing. Yeah, that's
Yeah. My husband plays music all the time. He can never be in silence, but I really need silence, and I don't like when people hum and interrupt, which is something my mother does, and my son, my oldest son, they're big hummers. And my mom is just so frustrated by it, but they're...
I like how in the book you offer the reader a kind of slow reveal of truths. Actually, really, even within just the first essay, I'm not talking about how each essay is a slow reveal of your life, but in the first essay, you begin in place with a cabin on a lake, and then you move into family, and then you move into, I think, sort of disease, but it was more cancer, I think, that you talked about first. But anyway, then you move gradually into story and secrets. But I think starting in place is a really wise move. It just gives us a visual of where we're going to be spending time. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about starting with place?
I think, you know, in some ways I'm a landscape writer. It's what I'm drawn to is the land and the visual representation of it. And, but I guess also too, you know, the book goes between homes. It has this literal sense of being between home. I go back to Minnesota, northern Minnesota, where I was raised and where a lot of my family still are. And then I come back to Vermont and I question where I should be in the world. And so, you know, I think starting with that visual place of the cabin in my childhood, that was a really potent metaphor for me because it was a place where I spent an idyllic childhood. You know, I had this really beautiful childhood where my mom and her sister and my cousins and my sisters and I all ran around in the woods and went swimming, and we had our grandparents, and then my grandfather died and when I was about 10 or 11, and the family kind of just started to slowly fall apart, and it also coincided with my own adolescence and becoming older and realizing that that, you know, life isn't idyllic. And so this place then eventually, you know, ends up being sold in a really kind of difficult way after my aunt died. And there were actually two cabins. One was my parents' cabin and one was my grandparents' that my aunt took over when my grandmother passed away. So it felt like a potent metaphor to be in that space and to kind of spool out the story of my family around this disease, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's a moment in the scene where your aunt has taken over your grandparents' cabin and she's removed a mirror that you used to like. This was so great. Like, you used to, as a child, enjoy the fact that when you came down the stairs, there was a mirror placed at the bottom of the stairs where you could see your feet, and then you could see your legs, and then you could see yourself coming into view, and then you could see your face. And so once that mirror was gone, you no longer had that experience anymore. And I loved
Joyce. Yeah, it was I think I call it a vital organ in the house or something like that. It was just... Yeah.
Let's see. Do you mind if I read a paragraph and then we can talk for a minute? Okay, great. Let me find it. This is from an essay called The Highway Home, and this is an excerpt. Highway 2 cuts through a landscape of beauty and desolation that composes the Upper Peninsula, craggy pine forests, pale sand beaches, and occasional wetland bogs with tree skeletons clustered like the naked masts of ships lost at sea. Small houses, some merely the size of sheds, with chipping paint and junkyard lawns appear along the highway. We pass few towns, then a bar and a tiny gas station that regretfully only takes cash, the elderly man explains, from his perch behind a counter. He bats the air with his hand and tells me something about the price of those machines or bounced checks. But the people here are friendlier, I think, unlike New Englanders who keep to themselves, mind their business at the grocery store. And it goes on, and I enjoyed it, but I'm not going to keep going. But in the same way that I thought that the opening of the book had this kind of slow reveal starting with setting, I thought this paragraph was like this kind of little microcosm of that, where we're starting with setting, and then we move into a man behind the counter, and then we move into a motion that he makes where he literally like bats the air. So I loved that. I wonder if you can maybe talk a little bit about writing setting, and maybe even in keeping in mind that maybe some people struggle with it, and and what might make that easier for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question, because I feel like that is really like my...
Right, it's not what you struggle with.
Not what I struggle
with. Which is awesome.
So, you know, I will say, as an essayist, so, and as any type of writer, I think you are going into landscape or scene, often remaining open to what you're going to find there. So trying to discover what it is you set out to discover, that's how I feel landscape comes alive for me, because I don't know, it's like if you try to describe your own house that you live in right now, I think it would be very boring to write about it. But when I'm writing about some place that I've been, or in my memory, or physically away from me, I really have to think hard to conjure up, okay, what was it like? What was there? How did it feel? And I let my mind just kind of take over, and almost always the landscape turns to story. Like, it always turns to, oh, and then this sort of thing that we came across. So
it's your kind of natural bridge into story.
Yeah.
It's funny, because, I mean, to some extent, I think people can work with what's hard for them and make it better. But I remember, I also went to Vermont College, and I remember being at a lecture by the author Larry Sutton. Did you know Larry?
Yeah, I did,
So he was giving this lecture, and he was talking about, like, you know, we have our forte and we have our weaknesses, and sometimes we just shouldn't write the stuff that doesn't come to us. He's like, for example, I'm a terrible, terrible nature writer. I can't write about the outside world. All I want to say is pretty. So it's funny. Okay. So, let's see. One of the characters that you introduce early on is your aunt, who you say a few times, you say she loves fiercely like a wildfire in her heart. It was interesting to me that you mentioned that a few times. And so I wondered what that meant to you, that she had a wildfire inside of her.
Well, she's also an alcoholic like me. And she her path, though, was very different, I think. And she was just a very intense person, but at the same time, that intensity could feel disruptive and somewhat destructive, I think, there was this intensity that we loved, especially as children, that, you know, it turned so sharply into depression and mm-hmm. into drinking and wildness.
Like, was it just mania? You know. Was there a manic aspect to her?
There was that. I mean, I don't know that we, like,
not diagnostically necessarily.
Not diagnostically, but yes, she loved being up at night, and she for a long time was a writer, and then she got sick and she became a soist is the word. I know this because one of my sisters is a soist. But and so she sewed all these really, she was so creative, and she did these this amazing work. And
that's the word for a person who sews?
Yeah.
S-E-W-I-S-T?
According to Bess, my sister.
I've never heard that. That's exciting.
It's,
I love new words.
Right? Yeah. Because she was this whole thing.
Yeah.
But that was my aunt, and as somebody with the disease of alcoholism, and I do think of it as a disease, I look to her as for help. Even, you know, I don't know that I ever said, can you help me? But I look to see what she was doing and how she was living. And so there's this aspect of identifying with her and also being afraid of what she struggled with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to just break in here for a minute and say you are listening to WBTV LP Burlington, 99.3 FM, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is an interview with the Vermont author Emily Arneson Casey. And if you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word. Emily, you describe the day that you started drinking as the first time you found relief from your anxious mind. I'm curious if your advice would be to look straight at the anxiety and not seek relief by turning away, or if I'm putting all kinds of words in your mouth and you want to just take it from here.
The anxiety, yeah. So usually, I mean, people have a lot of ideas about addiction, and some people don't feel like it's a disease. Some people feel like it's a coping mechanism. Some people think it's a disease and that you need to treat it your whole life. And so there's various ideas about it, and that might be a little bit part of the struggle of writing about it, even though it's been widely written about. I don't know. Like, if to look at the anxiety, the thing that was interesting to me is that I didn't realize that I was anxious and nervous and on edge until I had the relief. And then I was like, oh, well, I guess this is another way to be in the world. And why, you know, I thought of my mother, actually. I thought, why hadn't my mother told me about this? It was a fleet, you know, it wasn't a real, I didn't hold on to that thought. I knew exactly why she didn't, but I thought, right, this is so beneficial to me. Someone should have told me about it. And you know, a lot of people that have struggled with addiction and alcoholism will tell you that's a similar story, you know. Mm-hmm. There was great relief. And I don't actually, you know, I don't know why I was so anxious or, I mean, part of that's in the book too. It's like nothing, I use the refrain, nothing really bad ever happened to me. But people respond in all different ways to their life, so.
Well, that's interesting because you always hear people say that, you know, you have to hit rock bottom before you can find recovery. But it sounds like that was not your experience that you...
Well, I think...
Oh, there's different kinds of rock bottom, too.
There is. I mean, I was really in a hard place. Like, I write about it in The Blue Room is the closest I think I get to it. And I didn't really want to write a book that was all about rock bottom or about what it's like to drink, because I think there's a lot written about that. And... But it was a rock bottom for me. Everybody that I cared about had kind of bailed, and I had, you know, I felt very alone.
Right. So when you say nothing really bad ever happened, it's other than,
well, I don't mean like I wasn't traumatized. I didn't go through a major trauma, and that's, you know, there's a lot written about how trauma leads to addiction. Or addiction is a coping mechanism for trauma. So,
okay.
You know, yeah. I don't know. It's, yeah.
You've said a couple times now that there's been a lot of literature about addiction, but I also think what's also true that you said is that there are those who believe that it's a disease that it's you know sort of a lifelong struggle, and so I feel like all the literature is helpful, right, for people that need to continue to kind of dip back into literature and support and help.
Yes. Yes, I think that every story is different. It's just like any topic, I guess, you know?
Yeah, yeah. When did you write these essays? Did it happen over many years or a shorter amount of time? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, so the very first essay I wrote of this collection was The Blue Room, and I really think I wrote that in 2008. And then the last essay I wrote was the actual last essay of the book, Woodland Bound. And I think I wrote that in 2016, probably.
Okay.
And then the manuscript was accepted in 2017, and then it was a two-year process before publication.
Okay, now I was going to ask you about your publishing journey, so
yeah.
Let's just go there now. So mm-hmm. This book is part of the University of Georgia's Crux series on literary nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So what was your experience like of looking for a publisher? Was this a contest? Was this a submission?
It was a submission,
okay.
And I chose them because they're a university press, and they have a really great reputation. I knew one of my good writing friends had published a book with them, and she had a really great experience. And the Crux series kind of fit my writing style. Like
mm-hmm.
I felt like they were looking for something that was a little bit, you know, my writing is lyrical and meditative and not mm-hmm. straightforward narrative. And so it's not a good story, actually. It's not a fun story. I reached out to the editor of the series, and I sent him an email, and I attached the manuscript to the email, and I said, "Oh, I met you at this conference, and I think my friend maybe followed up." And I heard back from him like 2 months later, and he said, "We want to publish this."
Wow.
And I was like, "Oh, you do?
Are you sure?
And it was really it's, you know, I don't like telling this story because this is not the norm, but it was my first one that I looked to. And so I guess I just went with that. I didn't, you know, I really was excited and thrilled that they wanted to publish the book because I love their books, and I loved the idea of going through peer review, which I went through 3 times,
uh-huh.
Because you end up with a really amazing book.
Right, right.
They don't have a lot of money. A university press doesn't put a lot of money into publicity. So they have one publicist.
Right.
And so there's that end of it. But for a first book, I was really thrilled. And
mm-hmm.
so that's my story. I do have friends that, you know, they're continually looking for author for a publisher, and I mean out there, you know, shopping
right.
their work around. And
right. Do you have an agent?
No.
Okay. Let's see. The essay The Blue Room that you've mentioned a couple times is ordered within a series of lines. It's within a series of lines of poetry from T.S. Eliot's Four Quarters
and Quartets.
Four Quartets.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I wrote it down wrong. And Bill Holmes playing the black piano. So how did this structure come about? I'm always curious to know if structure sort of helps contain or helps guide, or if it comes out of the material itself for the author.
Mm-hmm. That came out of the material. I was writing that in real time.
Okay.
You know, I was devastated. My life was in shambles.
Yes, okay.
And I was writing it in real time, and I just, you know, that loop of poetry and then thinking back to this experience in Duluth, Minnesota, where I had been 4 years or 5 years before. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, actually, when I think about structure, because the essay really demands, you have to create a structure anew each time. And I actually think Annie Dillard writes in her writing, her little writing book.
Mm-hmm.
She says, you might as well write a book because every time you write something, you have to recreate a new structure. So whether it's a book or an essay or a short story, you're doing it again and again.
Right.
And so it's so much work to create that structure in an essay or in a short story or, you know, in a longer piece.
Mm-hmm.
So the I think the structure comes really organically for me, but I do know, like, there's definitely times that I've thought about how I need to create an essence or an aura. And, you know, like, I've reworked things. I mean, I'm really, really, this book has been edited, you know, I don't even know, hundreds of times some of these essays have gone through this process. So as you revise your essay, you develop that. It's like, you know, you whittle it down more and more, and you cut until you see, oh, okay, these threads are going together, and you're doing that process of linking it and thinking about, you know, what are the braids here, or
mean also linking various essays within the whole?
Well, no, I wrote each of the essays very independently, and it did, you know, I had to think about how to link it when I was going through peer review. They were like, how are you going to order this? This
right.
order is not working, and can you create a stronger connection between the themes? And
right.
So I did sort of a little bit of that when I was in peer review, but when I was coming, just doing the individual essays, it's always just inside that one essay, I'm thinking about how it's structured. And, you know, essayists, I think, spend a lot of time on structure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Now, you mentioned Annie Dillard a minute ago. I always like to ask my guests what they're reading these days.
Yeah.
So what are you maybe reading or have you read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Yeah, that's always like a funny question. I'm like, oh, I don't know.
It's like the one gotcha question.
I mean, I feel like it's an obvious question. Like, you know you're going to get that. So what am I reading? I'm reading The Bear and the Nightingale by Catherine, I'm going to forget her last name, but she was a graduate at Middlebury College. It's this really beautiful Russian, set in Russia,
okay,
magical fairy tale book, kind of. And
okay,
just because it fits with winter and I need to feel cozy as I'm entering this month. But I also...
Catherine Arden,
yes.
There
she's she's. I think it's a series, so I'm very excited.
Okay.
The other thing, you know, in my class right now, we just read an excerpt from Citizen by Claudia Rankine. Mm-hmm. So her book, Citizen, which was, I think it was published in 2014. So this is a, I would call it a lyric essay, the book itself. And I just love the way she talks about things like Serena Williams and the, you know, the racism she dealt with in the sport of tennis, and weaves that into like this really beautiful poetic language and these experiences and stuff. So she's really amazing. And I'm also reading a book by Melissa Mathewson.
Okay.
And she's actually one of our VCFA alums. So her book is called Tracing the Desire Line.
Okay.
And she's a writer out in Oregon. And her book is about her marriage and how she opened up her marriage and the experiences she had there and the evolution of her thinking about monogamy and love. And it's a really interesting, also kind of lyrical essay book.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, yeah. Those are great. They're all kind of different, so that's great. How about writing? Are you writing anything new right now?
I'm trying. I've got a lot of different little things going. You know, I do write fiction, so I have some fiction stuff I'm working on. I'm working on various essays. I recently did a little art talk in Winooski.
I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw that and I was like, oh shoot, I didn't announce that on the show last week because I didn't know about it.
I know. So I'm doing this art project is called The Essay Exhibits, and it is, I took my essay from Made Holy, The essay is called Beneath a Sky of Gunmetal Gray, mm-hmm. and it's in 8 parts. And so I assigned a part to 8 different Vermont visual artists. And
wow.
Yes. So it's just this essay. And so they each had, and it's a very fragmented essay. It's super abstract. And so I was amazed that these artists wanted to do this because I was just emailing them like, hey, do you want to do this project with me? And they were like, sure, why not? And I said, well, let's do it smaller. Let's do like the size of a book page or sort of around that size. And so these women, they're all women, responded with a visual piece of art and then they mailed it to me. And so I have the exhibit is the piece of art, and then I have on whiteboard next to it the text that goes along with it. And so right now it's on display at the Community College of Vermont in Winooski. They have a gallery on the second floor just in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I love looking, you know, I love this mix of the text alongside the painting or the collage or whatever. One is a sketch, kind of a pen and ink sketch. And the idea is that it's touring the Vermont libraries for the year. And
that's wonderful.
It's very exciting, yeah. And it's very overwhelming because, you know, then I kind of have to do an event at each library.
Did the Vermont Library Association get on board with you, or how did you
Well,
do that?
I just, again, just this is my organizing background I have. I'm also like an organizer, like community organizer.
Okay.
And I just called people and emailed them. And the project really came from my librarian, Kate, in Orwell, where I live, this tiny little library that's just adorable. And we talked about something like, how might I do a book launch in Orwell? And this idea just evolved into this. And she was like, oh, yeah, and you can show it here, and then you can show it at the other libraries, and I have these people. And
so she's a network that she can help
she
you with.
She did, but mostly I was just, emailing, being like, hey, do you want to do this? And the libraries were like, sure. You know, they make it clear, like bookstores, we can't guarantee anyone's going to show up event.
Yeah.
So we've been doing events, and it's just an interesting, I don't know that it's actually like selling my book or whatever, but I'm just showing up and doing it. And it's really been pushing me to do something different.
Now, speaking of libraries, makes me remember that you and I just met today, but we had pieces in the same collection that Angela Palm edited called Please Do Not Remove.
Yes.
So that was a wonderful collection. Mm-hmm. You should bring that along with you when put it on the table when you're
right
at the libraries.
That's a great idea. Yes. I'm
so
glad
those were,
you thought of that.
I'll just explain that those were pieces inspired by old used library cards that authors wrote pieces.
Yes. What was your library card? Do you remember?
I think it was something by... I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Mine was Call of the Wild.
Oh, wow. See, that's easier.
So random, yeah.
Okay, let's see how we're going here. I wondered if you might, at this point, have like a writing prompt that you might share for listeners who are writers.
Yes. Yeah, so I thought about this. I did a little writing workshop at my library where I live, and the theme in the writing workshop was writing places you can't return to. So my prompt is to write about a place you can't return to and see if you can find an object in that landscape of memory that maybe gives you some direction or shapes your understanding of that place.
Wonderful. Okay, that's great. Okay. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me, Emily. Before you go, I wonder if you can share the best place for listeners to learn more about your work, if they would like to.
So you can go to my website, I think would be the best place, emilyarnesoncasey.com.
Okay, wonderful. And thank you once again, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.com. So I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Vermont author Emily Arneson Casey, whose new book is Made Holy, published by the University of Georgia Press as part of their Crux series of literary nonfiction. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all of your friends. Next week on the show, I will again be live on the radio, and my guest will be on the phone, Ruta Sepetys, whose new historical novel for young adults is The Fountains of Silence, published by Philomel Books. And that takes place in Spain under Franco, which is a subject I'm very interested in because my most recent attempt at a manuscript is also set in Spain under Franco. So I'm excited to talk to Ruta Sepetys about that book. Okay, I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.